to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start the show today by talking with you about foraging. Have you ever foraged? Maybe you went out looking for mushrooms sometime or other wild edibles. It used to be that foraging was reserved for kind of hard times, but recently I think using wild ingredients in cooking has become kind of trendy. And our guest has been foraging for most of his life, and today we'll talk about wild prairie edibles with him. Sam Thayer, our guest, he's an expert in edible plants, also a maple syrup producer, a wild rice harvester, organic orchard owner, and the author of two books on edible wild plants, with a third one set to be released in November. So, what interests you about foraging? What questions or experiences do you have to share? I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or you can send us a message by posting on our Facebook page. Title of that page, The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to have your questions on Facebook. And if you've got some wild edible photos you want to include, why, put them up on the Facebook as well. Love to see them. Sam Thayer, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us again.
Well, thanks for having me on, Larry. I love being back here.
I loved having you. You've been into foraging for so long. How did you get going in that? What interests you in it?
You know, I was hungry as a kid, and I loved to be outside, and I put those two things together. And I picked up the information anywhere I could from anyone who would tell me anything. And then when I learned to read, it was from whatever I could get from books. So I've been slowly building on that my whole life.
Yeah, and that's really snowballed for you into bigger and better things. How does foraging and generally living off the land play in your life or into your life right now?
Well, I have three children, my wife and I and our kids. We eat wild food pretty much every day, and we kind of follow the seasons and collect and harvest and process things throughout the year. A lot of collecting in the late summer and fall, a lot of processing things, cracking and shelling nuts through the winter. And we also manage our property to be a wild food paradise. I have my orchard, but I also have a big brushy area that I am improving by encouraging the elderberries and the black cherries and the choke cherries and the nanny berries and all those things. So my brush looks like anyone else's brush to the untrained eye, but to my eye, I see lots and lots of food there.
And you have a store, right, in Bruce?
Yes, that's right. We have a commercial kitchen here where we make some products from the wild stuff that we harvest and from our orchard, and have a storefront here which is open intermittently when we're in here producing stuff and for events that we hold. And we sell a bunch of different, well, we have a small bookstore in here and also sell a bunch of stuff for foragers that you really can't get anywhere else.
Interesting. Well, why do you think foraging has become so popular?
Well, I think foraging is becoming more popular for the same reason that there's kind of an explosion of cooking shows and the whole foodie trend, is that people have realized that there is so much to explore in the world of food, and there's exciting different flavors that you can't get any other way. And also because it's part of the back to the land movement. It's a really great way to learn about nature and to connect yourself to nature. Because once you start gathering a plant, you start to love that plant and notice that plant and learn about it. And you learn about its ecology and everything that goes with it. And pretty soon, the natural world takes on this deeper meaning. It gives you this visceral relationship to nature that people love. And not everyone knows how much they love it until they experience it. But hunters and fishermen, they love the outdoors in this deep way, and so do foragers. And I think that's why once people start, they get hooked.
I always love having you on because you're always so enthusiastic, and of course you know a lot too. And you do a lot of speaking and workshops. You got one this weekend, I think, at River Edge Nature Center?
Yeah, I'm really excited for that. So I'm going to River Edge Nature Center. They have an event called Knee Deep in Prairies. It's an educational and fun event, all things prairie. And I'm going to be talking there about something that I call the Edible Prairie Garden, which not many people have heard of. But this is a concept for taking a small piece of your property, if you're in a part of the state that's appropriate for having a prairie, and managing it, restoring a prairie or taking care of a prairie remnant you might have, and really increasing its diversity by planting edible prairie plants, and that gives you an impetus to be out there and really take care of this small prairie remnant, which can become a paradise for prairie plants, prairie wildlife, whether it's butterflies or skinks or snakes and birds, and also a place that you can go out once or twice a week and collect something that you can put in your meals.
Yeah, it's really cool. Kathy on Facebook says she loves her chicory. People see it as a weed, but besides being edible, the goldfinches love it.
Well, you know, whenever you eat a plant, you get attached to it. And sometimes, now chicory is not a problematic invasive plant. It mostly sticks to roadsides. And sometimes our attachment to a plant that we eat can get in the way of our ecological thinking, and people plant some of these non-native plants where they shouldn't. But it really puts the plant in your mental map forever once you eat it and enjoy it.
Yeah. Eric on Facebook says he has hundreds of wild red raspberry and blackberry plants at his property in Juneau County. And there are also some wild blueberry plants, which are pretty yummy, as he likes to say.
Yeah, I mean, sandy soils are not the best for agriculture, but they have some really great foraging opportunities. Berries love sandy soil. We get, you know, blueberries, sand cherries, hazelnuts, you know, there's pin cherries and choke cherries and black cherries and blackberries and dewberries. I mean, sand seems to grow more berries than any other soil type.
Oh, man. Sam Thayer, our guest today, talking with him about foraging. And we're zeroing in a little on prairies today. Foraging in prairies, an interesting concept for me. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe experiences to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. So prairies, are there, obviously there must be some specific types of prairie edibles out there. What are some that we might see right now?
Sure. Well, one thing about foraging in prairies requires special attention to conservation, because prairies have been hit harder by human by the European settling of the Midwest, harder than any other habitat. And so there are not a lot of prairies left. So I encourage anybody that's going to harvest a prairie plant to really deeply understand that plant. But a great example is lead plant. Lead plant is considered a good prairie indicator species. It's a semi-woody shrub that anywhere from 4 feet tall to just a couple inches, and this makes a wonderful tea. And all the native tribes of the American prairies drank lead plant tea regularly. This is a good time of year to get it. Now, I like lead plant because it can sustain harvest very well. In fact, my father lives in Juneau County, and a stop sign near his house is mowed, and it is lead plant. It gets mowed twice a summer, but it comes up this thick, lush lead plant. In fact, the plant is so resilient that it's still grown for hay in parts of South Dakota and Nebraska. I
see
lead plant round bales just 2 years ago. This is just a wonderful way that you can I'll take maybe there's 12 stems per plant, and mm-hmm. I'll strip leaves off three of those 12, and if it can handle the mowing for hay, it can handle that, and as long as you keep it open and keep the sun on it and dry that for tea, and then you can sort of imbibe the scent and flavor of the prairie anytime you want year-round if you have a little bag of lead plant tea to brew up.
Oh, that sounds great.
And You know, when I was a kid, I went to high school in Madison, and I used to ride my bike around Madison, and I would pass all kinds of prairie remnants that are not there today. I loved to collect prickly pears, which the fruit ripens in September. There was a beautiful patch on Highway 78 between Mazomani and Sauk City. And I could, on a good year, I could fill, you know, a couple ice cream buckets full of that fruit, and they last 2 months in the fridge, and they're delicious. They did some road construction about 20 years ago, and they completely annihilated this whole hillside prairie that included all this prickly pear. Now, if we had a few more people that harvested these prickly pears in the wild, there might have been some voices to speak up, because it didn't have to be sheared off to do the highway work they did. And all these prairie remnants are disappearing. And I believe that if we are out there and experiencing the landscape that way, that there'll be people who will say, hey, wait a second, you can't do that, because that's this little prairie where I pick the prickly pears. And another great edible now is prairie clover. We have white and purple prairie clover. And these are gorgeous plants. In fact, they're so pretty that Meriwether Lewis on the Lewis and Clark expedition, he was supposed to conserve space to the max, but he had to collect 3 specimens of purple prairie clover because it was so gorgeous. I think he couldn't help himself. All the prairie nurseries, they like to rotate in every couple of years. They've got to have that one on the cover because it's so gorgeous, and people see it, and they say, what is that? I want that on my property. And it is every bit worth it. I have some that I bought from Prairie Moon Nursery that I put on my little prairie restoration. It is gorgeous, and the rabbits love it, and the deer love it, and the cows love it if you let them graze an area. But a little secret is the natives on the plains all ate that too, and those little greens for most of the summer make a really nice little addition to a salad, or to they have almost a pineapple-y flavor, and they also make a wonderful tea. And I tell you, I love my prairie clover, and I'm not going to let my prairie clover go away. I take good care of it, keep the rabbits out, but I take a little bit every summer for me, and that's another plant that I really love. And a lot of these plants that are edible are also beautiful. You can have your cake and eat it too, because plants keep growing and growing and growing if you give them the right conditions and take care of them.
Sam Thayer, our guest. Let's turn to Rocky in Coloma now. Rocky, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I was wondering if I could possibly get the name of the book your guest has written.
Sam, Rocky would like the names of the books that you've written.
Sure. The first one is called The Forager's Harvest. The second one is Nature's Garden. The one that's coming out this fall is called Incredible Wild Edibles. And really, there's no overlap in the plants they cover, but the theme and format is similar. I have multiple photos of the plants, and I just try to cover them in great enough detail that you'd feel comfortable collecting and eating these things on your own.
And so it's The Forager's
Harvest.
The second one is what?
Nature's Garden.
Nature's Garden.
And the third one is Incredible Wild Edibles.
There you go, Rocky. And how do we get copies?
Well, you can order them through any place that's convenient for you that sells books. I mean, you can get them through my website, you can get them through Amazon, or by supporting your local bookstore, however you'd like to do it.
Yeah, the local independents, I'm sure, are always happy to help out with that as well. Sam Thayer, our guest again. Rocky, thank you for calling. If you have a question or comment as we talk with him about foraging, zeroing in a bit on prairies now, but we could take some other questions in the foraging area too, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45 today, we'll be talking about broadband internet access and how it can affect small businesses and help them. That's at 11:45. Right now, we're taking a look at foraging and foraging on the prairies a bit as an emphasis, but we'll take other questions as well in that area at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. Josie sent us a nice photo and a comment. Here's one of my top five picks when it comes to wild edibles in this region. It's shagbark hickory nuts. They're absolutely delicious, better than pecans, and are much more cold tolerant. Thus, they can be found here. However, they only produce heavily, usually only every 4 or 5 years. So that's a comment from Josie. What do you think about that, Sam?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think shagbark hickory is the best nut I've ever tasted. Anytime we get a decent crop, I'll try to get a few 5-gallon buckets full if the squirrels will spare them for me.
There you go. Thanks for that post, and she's got a really nice photo up of it as well. Dan in Poinette, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. Great show.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a comment about staghorn sumac tea, which is really great this time of year. It makes a beautiful red tea if you steep it overnight in cold water. And you can add a little natural wild honey to it to sweeten it if you like. But the plant is also really beautiful to look at in the fall. It turns a really bright, burnt red-orange color that's amazing to have on your property.
Ah, thanks for that call. Sam, a comment?
Well, again, I couldn't agree more. We've been enjoying the sumac tea this year, and the flavor varies a lot from year to year, and I find that this year it's got some of the best flavor we've had in a long time. So if you've never tried the sumac tea, I would go out and do it now. And if you are worried about poison sumac, I would have you know that the poison sumac berries are white and they're in drooping grape-like clusters. They're nothing like the erect, fuzzy red clusters on the staghorn sumac or shining sumac or the smooth sumac. Those three species we have in Wisconsin all have very good tasting fruits for making the sumac tea or sumac lemonade, as people call it.
And how do you prepare that? What do you do?
Just like the caller said, I'll take the whole heads and I taste them first to make sure they're tangy. They should be like licking a lemon. I mean, really sour. And then I'll take about 6 or 7 of those heads and I'll stuff them in a pitcher, pour cold water over the top, and then I'll stick my hands in there, kind of agitate a little bit to break things up, and then pour a little more cold water to fill the pitcher. You can let it sit overnight, as the caller suggested, but if you've got really strong flavor, in 15 minutes you'll have enough flavor to pour that out through a little cloth to strain it, pour it through a jelly bag or something to get the fuzz out that's on the berries, and then you've got your lemonade right there. We've done some other things. We have mixed it with elderberry juice, which it adds a tang that the elderberry juice lacks. Right now I've got a batch of blueberry sumac wine going, just a little batch. So there's a lot of ways to use it. And you can take the heads and snip them off and dry them, and then you can brew that anytime you want during the winter.
Very good. Thanks again, Dan. Appreciate it very much. Steve in Franklin up next. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Larry. How are you doing?
Great.
I have a question for Sam about a prairie restoration. I guess me and my wife are just starting to have a small little area in our yard that we're trying to restore to a prairie. I was wondering if you could basically tell me what the first step would be to do this.
Well, the first step is to figure out your soil type and then figure out what prairie plants would be appropriate to that type, because the difference between rich, mesic, dark soil that you'd find, say, in Dane County is totally different than, say, a sandy soil you might find in Columbia County. And the appropriate plants will vary quite a bit. But I really applaud what you're doing, because all over rural Wisconsin, there are thousands and thousands of yards that are bigger than anybody needs. And somebody could take an acre and a half of one of these 5-acre lawns and make a beautiful prairie remnant, which could really be significant habitat. It sounds like you're going to do something like that, and I think that's great. Now, if it's already cleared and it's lawn, then you can you can till that and plant prairie seed in there. Or if it's small enough, you can tarp it to kill off the grass. But before you would start a restoration project like that, I would talk to somebody at one of the nurseries, like Neil DeBoll at Prairie Nursery, the people at Prairie Moon, or if it's slightly larger, there are people that work in prairie restoration that would be able to help you. You'll want to start with a set of native grasses and some of the common prairie forbs, but, you know, you may want to tailor your seed mixture to include some of the edible plants you might want to promote. Or once you put in your original prairie, a lot of people like to stand back and just look at that prairie and think, I'm done with this now. I put in a prairie. But if you decide, here's six different species that'll grow good on my prairie, and I'm going to transplant some individual populations of those, that gets you out there to tend them, to look at them, to mulch them, to weed around them, and it keeps you in constant contact with what your little prairie remnant needs. And over years, you'll find, ooh, I want this plant, ooh, I want this plant, and your prairie will slowly grow in diversity with your continual care.
Mm.
One thing
that you recommend burning parts of it, like, to get it started, because that's what we kind of already have done. We burned a whole bunch of brush on certain areas and then planted after, obviously after the coals have been, like, you know, put out. Is that something you recommend?
Exactly. Now, I mean, a prairie is a native community that is dominated by herbaceous plants, including grasses, rather than woody plants like trees and shrubs. And here in Wisconsin, we're at the prairie forest border, so the prairie and the forest are fighting for space. The fire is the prairie's ally, and without occasional to frequent burning, you cannot have a prairie in this region. So that's what made our prairies, is the fires. And so prairies are defined in this region in that they are inhabited by fire-adapted species. And so exactly that. If you had a brushy area to start with, the first step would be to burn off the brush, and you may find, depending on where you are, that you have a good complement of prairie species that were struggling to survive mixed with that brush, that then they're going to come in and be able to take over. And then you can assess what you have, and you could do spot plantings or spot transplantings or seeding on top of or in addition to the diversity that you already have.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably well worth it to go to one of the websites of a place like Prairie Nursery, because they have a lot of information just on the site itself as to how to get a prairie going. And a lot of the information that Sam just mentioned, Steve, so I hope you'll do that. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Renata in Lake Mills up next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I had a question, a follow-up on the prickly pear cactus. My understanding is that is native to Wisconsin, and I'm not sure if that's correct or not. Maybe your guest knows. And I'm wondering where a person can go and purchase that to plant in a little prickly pear cactus bed.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So it is definitely native to Wisconsin. There's at least two species native to Wisconsin. And some botanists have debated for a long time whether or not we have Opuntia humifusa and Macrorhiza, or just humifusa. So we have at least two and maybe three native species of prickly pear. They are sporadically distributed, but in certain parts of the state are very abundant, at least the humifusa prickly pear is, and that's the one I collected as a child. They will do very well any place in Wisconsin that is sandy and well-drained, but particularly in the southwestern half of the state. So there's native prickly pears, you know, all the way up by St. Croix Falls, and there's native prickly pears in the Eau Claire area. There's native prickly pears along the whole lower Wisconsin floodplain. I'm sure you can find a nursery that has them. I can't tell you one off the top of my head. I have a good friend who lives along the lower Wisconsin River and has them in his yard, and I transplanted from his yard to my little prairie restoration, which here in Bruce, we're north of the normal range of prickly pears, but they seem to be doing okay, although the rabbits like them more than I thought they would. And once you get a thriving colony of prickly pears, every year or two, I mean, they'll take a few years off, but they'll give you these delicious little pear-shaped fruits.
Mm, there we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And by the way, you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Amos in La Crosse up next. Hi, Amos.
My name is Ron.
Ah, Ron. Well, I'm sorry, Ron. Let's...
Yeah, this wouldn't have anything to do with prairie foliage. I have this tree in my growing in my backyard garden, and I was thinking about cutting it down. It, you know, grew from seed, and after a few years, number of years, all of these berries started to appear on it. And one of your staff people who just took my call said probably elderberry, but it just proliferates every other year. And then the next year, it just goes dormant. It doesn't produce anything. But when the berries are just halfway ripe and say kind of a red, they're very tasty. I mean, they're you know, they're tangy. And then when they get turn purple, well, I don't care for them as much. They're still edible. And then they fall off to the ground. So
yeah,
we used to have raspberries in our garden. But, you know, I mean, and, yeah. But anyway, I just thought I'd let you know that sometimes if you see a tree or something, you might want to wait a while before you think about cutting it down.
All right. Sam?
Ron, are these ripening in late June, early July?
Yes, I would say so.
Yeah, so what you have is almost certainly a mulberry. It kind of looks blackberry-like, but it's a full-size tree.
Yes.
Yeah, then that would be a mulberry, and almost certainly that would be the non-native white mulberry. White mulberry normally has a purple fruit when it's ripe, despite the name. So that's almost certainly what that is.
Oh, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Justin in Oshkosh emailed to ask you if to talk about the traditional uses of acorns in Wisconsin, especially in the Fox Valley.
Well, you know, that's a huge subject that I can't cover in a few minutes, but acorns were not a staple food source for Native people in Wisconsin, at least not during the last couple thousand years, but they were a significant food source for most of the Native people here, as in it was kind of a supplementary food to corn or wild rice, or those are the two primary staples in this region. You know, we have 7 or so species of oak in Wisconsin, and all the acorns are edible, and all of them to be eaten in quantity should be leached, as in either ground up and soaked in cold water and the water drained off, or they can be left whole or in larger chunks and then boiled and have the water drained off. And you'll find both methods were used throughout North America, but the boiling of whole acorns was used more in Wisconsin, and the grinding and then cold leaching was used more in the western United States. So that's a very brief explanation of the use of acorns. But my book, Nature's Garden, has a 50-page chapter on the use of acorns, which is the longest chapter in any of my 3 books.
There we go. We wonder, let's see, Andy in Mount Horeb wonders if there's anything that can be harvested from prickly ash.
You know, prickly ash, the genus Xanthoxylum is the same genus that Sichuan pepper comes from. Now, I do know a few people that use prickly ash, both the leaves and the berries, in as a seasoning in cooking, but it isn't used really as a food. Now, there's actually multiple species in that genus that are used as seasonings in Asia. I'm not intimately familiar with how they're prepared, whether or not they're dried and roasted, or they fermented and roasted, or any of that. I do know that the prickly ash fruit, if you just eat it or even if you use it in food, it has a numbing characteristic. So it's sort of the opposite of what I want in a seasoning, is you don't really taste your food if you have prickly ash fruit in it, because it numbs your tongue. It can be used as a seasoning.
We have another comment from, let's see, Jeff from Wind Lake called to ask you to talk about burdock and how to eat it.
Well, burdock is one of those multifaceted edibles that is really common and available to a ton of people. And if you go to different health food stores throughout the United States, including in Wisconsin, you can find burdock root for sale. There's at least one and maybe 2 farms in Wisconsin that grow burdock root. And so that's probably the best known use. You can harvest the root of burdock at any time from a plant that does not have the stalk. So you look for just the basal leaves. The root can be enormous. Like, I have dug them up as much as 5 pounds in one root. I have dug them up to 44 inches long. And burdock is gobo in Japanese, and it's the traditional standard everyday root vegetable in Japanese cooking. And it's just as good here. But we do have three species of burdock: great burdock, common burdock, and woolly burdock. The Japanese gobo is the great burdock, which depends on what part of the state you're in. It ranges from very common to hard to find. Madison area has a lot of common and great burdock. It has both species. For example, where I live is more great burdock than common. You can also eat the young stalk in early summer, late spring or early summer. Cut the stalk at the base, peel the outer layer, which is tough and bitter, and inside you have what's kind of like a potato stick. It's starchy. It can be up to an inch and a half in diameter at the base, and you can slice that up and stir fry with vegetables. You can use it in a pot roast, just kind of a mild, we call them like burdock potato sticks. I know that's kind of a silly name, but that's how we think of them culinarily. They get more tender as you get towards the top of the plant, and they get greener towards the top of the plant. But once that burdock is branched out at all, there is no more tender stalk, and you're kind of done with burdock until the next season.
The next spring or something.
Yeah, at least the stalks. But you can get the root at any time of year, because that plant will often grow for 3 years before it produces a stalk. So even in the middle of summer, you'll find plants that have only basal leaves from which you can dig up a root.
Ann posted a photo of a giant hen of the woods mushroom. She found it in her backyard woods last October. She's hoping to find more again this year. She loves the hunt and exploring nature.
Yeah, hen of the woods is a great mushroom because it is so big, and it's a pretty good mushroom. And it tends to produce, form on the same oak trees year after year. So she's got a really good chance to get another load of hens from that tree this year.
We have Josie sent a photo of a black walnut. It's saying it's producing more abundantly than I've ever seen it this year. Top-notch year for nuts kind of all the way around.
Yeah, I agree. Last year was a very poor year for nuts statewide, especially acorns. This year is a moderately good year for acorns, but it's a fabulously good year for black walnut and hickory, and a moderately good for butternut. So I'm looking to have a pretty good nut crop this year.
And Roger wrote in to say on Facebook to say it was always great to hear Sam on the show. Wondering again, and we talked about this earlier, but it bears repeating, if you're going to be teaching any places this fall. And then a second question, are some of the invasive plants in prairies edible, like wild parsnip?
All right. Well, that is a great question. So, yeah, I have this program this weekend, Knee Deep in Prairies, and I'm teaching a day-long class there, which is filled up, but there is still room for that's on Saturday, but for the main event, which has a whole bunch of educational workshops on Friday, there's still room there, and people can hear my talk on Friday if they want to come to that, which is a great event. Later in the fall, the last weekend of September, I'm going to be at the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival, and I'll be teaching several different workshops at that event. I also, I've got a mushroom workshop that I'm teaching with a mycologist up here in Bruce the first weekend of October. And then I'll be in West Virginia in between then, doing an event for the West Virginia DNR. And as far as the invasive plants that are edible, a number of them are. And parsnip is one that if a prairie is well seeded and burned, it generally the parsnip gets outcompeted by the perennial plants of the prairie. But it does sometimes invade tall grass prairies or prairie remnants, in which case you might want to get the parsnip out. And parsnip parsnip, wild or domestic, is the same plant, and the leaves can cause a rash on either plant, but that usually happens in June and July when the plants are juicy. In November, when parsnips are traditionally harvested, it's almost impossible to get a rash from them unless you really try to squeeze the juice out of those leaves and get it on your skin. So I dig parsnips in November, and they're just as good as domestic parsnips, but they average a little bit smaller. That's probably our most prevalent prairie invasive. But I always tell people, if you gather in a prairie, always look for invasives and take them out if you can. For example, the prairie clover that I mentioned and I love, it's getting outcompeted very seriously in many of the prairie remnants by spotted knapweed. And so if I'm going to pick a few sprigs of prairie clover, I'm going to go pull out 30 or 40 spotted knapweed plants. And I think if we had more people picking prairie clover, we would actually have a lot more people pulling out the knapweed, and we'd have a lot more prairie clover.
There we go. Larry in Eau Claire has something for us. Larry, hi.
Yes, Leon?
Yes, go ahead.
Is a horse chestnut or a buckeye, are they edible? I'll hang up and listen to your comment.
So generally speaking, they're not. But native people in different parts of the world have figured out a way to detoxify those nuts by grinding them up and soaking them and leaching them out, like acorns are leached, after which they are fairly good. But most people find it's not worth the effort. There are actually people that still do it as a significant food source in parts of Japan and Korea. But generally, just to take them off the tree and eat them, they're toxic enough to be dangerous, particularly our native ones. The European horse chestnut is a little less toxic, but you still don't want to be eating it.
Yeah. Jean said a nice note on Facebook. She said, last October, several of my coworkers and I volunteered a day of seed collecting and removing of invasives. She did it for the Mississippi Valley Prairie Conservancy, and it was a lot of fun. Some hard work, but it was really great to be in the out of doors. And I'm sure that's something that you are supportive of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I started out as a Nature Conservancy volunteer when I was 14 years old, and I did grunt work. I did clearing, invasive plants like buckthorn and native invasives like red cedar and sumac, from prairie restoration sites, and helped with prescribed burns, and I licked envelopes, and I've been supportive of prairie conservation my whole life, and I wouldn't want anyone to think that I'm saying, oh, let's just go eat the prairie and don't worry about it. But when you start eating these plants, then you start appreciating them in a very deep way, and you start thinking, how can I help and how can I give back to the prairie? And I encourage anybody who has the desire to get involved in conservation to do some prairie restoration work and learn about this fascinating array of plants that we have.
Sam, do you have a website or Facebook page? Or?
My website is forgesharvest.com. My classes are posted there. I'm not on Facebook, but I believe my wife maintains a Facebook page with some updates of what I'm doing and what we're doing and things relating to our business.
Foragersharvest.com.
Yes.
We have a link on, yeah, Jill's got a link up on our Facebook page. Lexi Broach has joined us as well. Hi, Lexi. She's an intern and just making a surprise appearance here. And it's never a surprise when you're on, Sam, that it's always a lot of fun and invigorating. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for bringing attention to prairie conservation.
Sam Thayer is an expert, obviously, in edible plants. He's got three books, one coming out soon. I have to have him back when that book comes out. The two that are out right now, The Forager's Harvest is one, Nature's Garden is the other, and then the one coming out is Incredible World of Edibles. Those are the three books that are coming out. And again, you can go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show if you want to link up to his website, or just type his name in. You're probably going to find it pretty quickly. Well, we are going to switch gears in just a minute and talk with you about broadband and business and community development and working with some UW Extension folks to make it more available to every rural area of Wisconsin. That coming up next on the Ideas Network.